Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is April the 4th, 2024. This is episode 3,407 of the Survival Podcast, and it is Thursday. That means it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week, and I have got a great lineup for you today. A lot of members of the council coming in today. We got Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini talking about how the deep state is hell-bent on continuing the war in Ukraine, even if the new POTUS doesn't want it. They're laying the groundwork to make it, if Trump wins, it'll still be almost impossible to extract ourselves from this crap. John Pugliano says, I sent this to John. As many of you know, if you are a cryptocurrency trader or a Bitcoin trader, neither or, there is no wash rule in the world of Bitcoin, meaning, let's say, you had a bunch of money, and during this recent run-up, you aped in with a whole bunch, let's say $200,000 worth of Bitcoin when it was trading for, let's say, 70-something thousand, and now it's down like 64. Well, that would be a pretty big loss. So what you could do, and you probably should do if we're talking about, straight up Bitcoin, is you could sell it, immediately buy it back, capture the capital loss, reestablish your basis, and go on about your life. And it's completely legal because Bitcoin's not subject to the wash rule. But ETFs are publicly traded securities, so they probably are. And I said, John, how does that work? If you can, and what are any of the potential gotchas, like kind exchanges between, let's say, Grayscale Bitcoin Trust and iBit? So John will talk about that. I thought it was an interesting one. That actually came not directly as a question. It was a different question that made me go, this person probably doesn't have enough loss to make it worth the fees. And then I immediately thought, well, the fees on the ETFs are like a quarter point. But wait a minute. So we'll talk about that today. Sean Mills will talk about setting up solar with propane generators as backups. Really a great way to go. Person was wondering if there's any way to do it. There's plenty of ways to do it. Sean will talk about some of them. Eric Hammond will talk about picking a diesel truck between Ford, Chevy, and Dodge. And he has some things that seem very anti-diesel. They're not. They're anti-diesel at a certain class of truck. And I tend to agree fully with this. And having been a diesel mechanic in the military many years ago, I will throw in some thoughts. And a diesel owner for quite a bit of my life as well, some additional kind of tag team top rope elbow into these like mid-scale trucks with diesel motors. They economically don't make sense. They really don't. Doc Bones will talk about how dangerous mold can be. We're talking about the kind of mold that grows on the walls of a house, especially if you're like a handyman or something like that, or a contractor that has to open these walls up. Nicole Sauce will talk about a recipe for moral mushrooms. Nick Ferguson will talk about how to know if you have planted, patented, or trademark variety plants and what the rules are with the propagation of those. And I have one little addition to that that Nick left out. He probably is aware of it, but it's actually a pretty broad question. But there is a sneaky little thing that patent holders of plants do in catalogs, and you should know about it so you can go, that's nice, but it doesn't mean anything. Kind of like in Texas, when you are a concealed carry license holder and you go to a store and it has a picture of a gun on it with a slat, like Ghostbuster sign, it means nothing to you if it's not posted under the specific code of 30.06, which is kind of ironic in a gun world, then it doesn't mean anything to a licensed carrier at all. It has to be done in a certain way. It's the same but different, man, in the words of Tommy Chong. And then I will talk about, and this is a compost question, and I'll read it when I get to my segment, but I'm going to reframe it a little bit so that it's more broadly applicable to any decision in your life. When everything is working for you, do you need to do anything else? And in the show notes, I said in your gardens. But I think that it's bigger than that. There's a lot of things you can do to improve a situation, but if you're happy with the way things are, do you need to do them? Should you do them? And I think more importantly, how do you determine when it's worth doing something to improve something that's already working when what you're getting out of it is everything that you currently want? And also how to think differently from a standpoint of, well, will this make things better now or will this ensure the long-term viability of the system? Is another way to look at things. And again, we'll come at it from a gardening composting question, but we will try to broaden that, because one of the most important things I can do on this show is to help you figure out how to think about things. Now, you notice I didn't say what to think about things. I don't want the job of telling people what to think, because I think that is borderline, you know, brainwashing, and it certainly enters the world of the mainstream media's programming of the minds. I do not want to program minds. I want to empower self-programming. You are the lead programmer of the 3-pound computer between your two ears. It is the most powerful computer known to humans, and it's in your brain, and it's in your head. It's your brain. And that's true of even people you think of that are just stupid. They actually have incredible computing power compared to anything that we think of as artificial intelligence or computer banks or anything like that. Because they can do things that no machine can, at least yet. And how do we activate that computer to make decisions for ourselves instead of have them made for us by others? And how do we use that computer to say, hey, in this instance, I'm going to rely on somebody else to help me that knows more than I do, but how do I make sure I'm relying on the right person? So we will dig all of that out of a question on composting. With that, let's go ahead and dive on into it today. Some words from Dr. Paul and his folks with the Liberty Report on how the deep state is planning to continue this Ukraine war forever, damned who gets elected next. That's pretty unconstitutional, by the way, too.
They're ganging up on Trump. Yeah. I know you can't believe this, but they think that Trump might even be serious about some of the things he says, even though we say, well, we'll wait and see exactly what he does and who he appoints. But Trump has said some things about NATO, which is not flattering, and some people like all the power, and they see a guy like Trump might just take over. Uh-huh. So what's this whole idea now? Trump proofing weapons for Ukraine. Allies consider moving arms group into NATO.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, then there's, hey, you know, that's not so bad. Maybe there'll be competition between it. Who's running the show? But, of course, we always run the show because we have the most money, we have the biggest military, and we've been fibbing so long that people just can't ever believe that our currency will fail or that we'll run out of bombs, because no matter how many bombs we give away and provide for everybody, people, next day, more bombs. We got it. We're in business. That's our whole business.
Yeah, I mean, you say it's ganging up against Trump, which is only partly right, because I think it really is ganging up against the American people. It's ganging up against democracy. It's ganging up against the voter. I mean, it's a blatantly anti-democratic move. They're taking an entity which provides weapons for Ukraine, and we are the majority funder of that entity, the U.S. taxpayer. It's taking it out of the hands of the U.S. president. It's taking foreign policy out of the hands of the U.S. president and putting it in an organization, you know, a multinational organization. I mean, it basically says no matter who you vote for, you're going to get war, whether you like it or not. And if there's a danger that Trump might come in and put an end to this war, well, we're going to take away his ability, taking away the American president's ability to conduct foreign policy. Well, let's look at the article. It's from Politico, and we actually have two related articles, and they're both on the same theme. Trump proofing weapons for Ukraine. Allies consider moving arms group into NATO. Go to the next one. Here's what the article is all about. The U.S. and other Western countries are considering transferring to NATO a U.S.-led multinational group that coordinates the shipments of weapons to Ukraine. One of several new proposals, and I underline this, that could help maintain the flow of arms to Kiev under a second Donald Trump presidency. So again, bypassing the U.S. president and getting the aid to Ukraine without regard to what that president wants. It's dangerous. I mean, it's taking foreign policy, the U.S. foreign policy, away from the U.S. You know, it doesn't matter who you vote for. This is going to be the policy, you know. And that's why Trump was impeached in the first place. He didn't want to release that military aid to Ukraine way back when. And they said, well, you have to do it. It's the interagency consensus. We have to support Ukraine. And he says, well, I'm a little skeptical about that. Okay, you're impeached. You know, I mean, that's what they did. So it's a tyrannical time.
Oh, well, we'll impeach him.
Yeah.
That'll destroy his reputation 6 months later, or I don't know.
He's stronger. Yeah.
Well, we need to do that again. Yeah. It didn't work. We'll say nastier things about him. It is so crazy.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I don't know that the angle that they're talking about there will directly work. What I do see the potential for is this. A Congress that approves a massive amount of funding right before or even after the election, and make sure that the money is spent before anybody gets in office to change it. That's something that's done many times when a new president's coming in, who says, you know, we're not going to do this thing. If the Congress has enough horsepower, they can get it done. And there's definitely enough rhinos to get shit like this done. It'd be great if we could just stop screwing stuff up in the world. I'll just leave it at that today. Let's talk about something totally different. How does it work out when you have a commodity like Bitcoin not subject to, in investing, what's known as the wash rule? And again, that simply means, if I was holding Ford stock right now, and Ford had a bad day, some bad news came out about Ford, which happens often, and it tumbled the stock price in half, and I had gone in at, let's say, $20, $100,000 worth of stock, and it dropped in half to 50, well, that's a $50,000 loss, but only if I sell the stock and take the loss. And the government has no problem with that. I can sell Ford and I can take the loss, but I have to wait 90 days to buy back in. Now, if the bad news was something like they found somebody's thumb in a glove box or something, I know this is a short-term hit, I might want to do that, but I don't want to give up my position in the stock that I originally bought. So I have to if I want to take the loss. I would have to buy Chevy or, I don't know, you know, Instagram, or, you know, I can buy Alphabet, or I can buy anything. What I can't do is go buy the same security back. Bitcoin, I could lose $100,000, sell it, and buy it back instantly. And I could video myself doing it, send it to the IRS with my tax return, and they're okay with it. I'm following the rules. So that's the commodity, but the ETF is not the commodity. It's a container for the commodity. So I asked John what were his thoughts on this. My thought would be that it is subject to the wash rule because it's a public security. Let's see what John has to say.
Hello, TSP. Today I want to talk to you about Bitcoin and the wash rule. Now, this is something that Jack brought up, and I wanted to chime in with my thoughts on it because I've heard a lot of talk of people offering what I think is some bad information when it comes to the wash sale rule and how it affects Bitcoin transactions versus Bitcoin ETFs. Now, if you trade stocks or securities, you're probably aware of something called a wash sale rule. And the wash sale rule states that if you sold a security at a loss and you buy it back within 30 days of selling it at that loss, then it's a wash sale, meaning that for tax purposes, you can't immediately count that loss as a tax expense against your other gains. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't write that loss off at all. The loss is still preserved. It's just that within that 30-day period that you've bought back into the stock, that loss is just carried forward and aggregated into the eventual gain or loss that the stock has when you finally do sell it and don't buy it back after the final 30-day period. Now, what's interesting about the wash rule is that it applies to securities, a security being a financial product like stocks or bonds or options or derivatives, but it doesn't apply in the same way to physical things like collectibles, real estate, or in particular, Bitcoin. And so people that have been swing trading Bitcoin have been able to take advantage of the fact that wash rules don't apply to it, and so you could sell Bitcoin at a loss and turn around and immediately buy it back. A trade like that would particularly be important at the end of the year if you're trying to lock in a loss, you know, say on December 30th or December 31st, and you want to lock in that loss for that particular year, and then with something like Bitcoin, which can be extremely volatile, you wouldn't want to sit on your hands for 31 days waiting to be able to buy back into it, so you could sell, take the loss, and then immediately buy back to catch it on a bounce. That's a big advantage you have by trading Bitcoin that you wouldn't have by trading just a traditional stock or bond or security. Now, where this comes into question is, what about Bitcoin ETFs? And again, this is where I've seen and heard a lot of people passing information that I don't think is accurate, and I want to state right up front, I'm not a tax expert. What I'm going to tell you is my opinion and my observations. But if you're in this situation, I would advise that you do speak specifically to a tax expert, someone that can discuss your particular trading situation and can give you adequate advice and be there to represent you should you get a letter or an audit from the IRS. Okay, but here's just my thoughts and observations. The wash rule, which doesn't apply to physically buying Bitcoin, does apply when using a spot Bitcoin ETF. And I know right away some people are saying, but that's not true because if you look at something like gold, which doesn't have a wash rule, and you trade the gold ETF GLD, it also has tax characteristics which mimic those of buying physical gold. But the big difference there, if you read the perspective on GLD, you'll see that it's actually set up as a trust. And as such, that trust owns physical gold, and it does preserve the characteristics of the investors that buy into GLD and gives them the same or similar tax structure that you would encounter if you were selling physical gold, because GLD doesn't have the traditional tax structure of a security like a regular stock or ETF. I know this is convoluted, but if you remember GBTC, the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, it had been a trust, but it is no longer a trust. It is acting and functioning as an ETF, just like the other nine or so spot Bitcoin ETFs that are out there. And because they are true ETFs, meaning they're a securitized financial product, and they are subject to the wash rule, and as such, if you have a loss and you sell it and you immediately buy it back, you're going to see on the capital gain statement that you receive from your broker that they have reset your cost basis and they're aggregating your old loss into that current position. So your broker will take care of that situation. But here's where the bad advice is coming in that I'm hearing from people. And they're saying you can work around that situation by selling and taking a loss in a Bitcoin ETF like IBIT, IBIT, and then turn around and immediately buy back into another Bitcoin fund like FBTC or EZBT or BIT or BITB or whatever. And there, I think, is where the very bad advice is coming in, is that that is not a workaround. That still violates the wash rule, because the wash rule says you can't buy the same security or a substantially identical security. Now, here's where the gray area comes in, is because the rule doesn't say substantially similar. It says substantially identical. You know, what does identical mean? Normally, when you're dealing with stocks, you can say, well, I'm going to sell ExxonMobil, but I'm going to buy Chevron because they're similar, but they're not identical. And that carries over into the ETF world as well, where you can say, well, I'm going to sell the S&P 500 index fund, but then I'm going to buy right back into a large cap index fund, which is similar, but not identical. But in my opinion, none of that applies to Bitcoin ETFs, because all of these ETFs are 100% invested in Bitcoin, and the only variation is really the difference of transaction fees and spreads. And so I think to make the case that these are not substantially identical securities is not going to go down very well with the IRS. Hey, in any case, bottom line, when you have tax questions, don't take the advice of some guy on social media or a guy on a podcast. Go out and hire a tax professional that can talk to you about your specific situation. Well, thanks for the questions. Until next time, this is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealth Studying Podcast.
You know, the bigger problem with this, I do think John's right. But here's the big problem. So this is brand new. This has never been a thing before the way that it is now. It would take one Karen and the IRS Department of Compliance Issues or something like that to type up one memo issuing guidance on what the right answer to this is. And they won't. They are shit at issuing guidance. You have to guess. And they do that because since we have fear of the IRS, rightfully so, and the more that you have, the more you should fear, because the more they can take from you, it will always be the case that most people filing will file to the level of caution. If it looks like it probably is the case that you can't do a thing, then don't do it. Let somebody else do it. And eventually the IRS will issue guidance, and then, you know, you can even go back and say, well, guess what? I didn't claim this. Now, it wouldn't work in this particular area, probably, because you wouldn't do it unless you thought you could get the deduction. But there are people that will go back and retroactively file after guidance is issued. Very few people will, but some will. I've done it. I've actually had, when some guidance came out about something totally different, I ended up getting like an extra $1,500 back from a prior tax year because my account was badass, right? And actually picked up on it and said, hey, I think we can do this now, and it worked out. But what they'll do, and this is my big problem with government as a whole, especially alphabet organizations like the IRS, is they can just change their mind about things with no laws being passed one way or the other. They decide how they execute codes and laws because they're on the executive side of government, and there's some, you know, there is some presidential oversight and all, but in the end, there's bureaucrats that just make decisions. Think about what's gone on with the ATF's bullshit with his pistol brace, pistol, an SBR, or just a pistol with a brace, and how many times that's changed with no laws being passed whatsoever. It's ridiculous. So if the IRS is going to enforce something a certain way in a given tax year, and that thing has not been a matter of course, then it should issue guidance, which it won't. And if you call the IRS and say, what is the proper course of action here? They'll say, ask your CPA, who doesn't know either because they haven't issued guidance against it yet. And this is why I find the entire concept of income tax to be a scam. If the government is going to set rules, those rules need to be clear, the limits need to be concrete, and it needs to be easy to understand. Instead, what they do is they create this convoluted pile of bullshit, and then if you guess wrong, they come after you. And then we call ourselves free because we've been conditioned to be stupid. And that brings up something I'm probably going to do next week. Stupid. I do not mean stupid as in intellectually slow. I mean that we are stupid in that we trust government and we know we should not. We are stupid in the concept of Bonhoeffer's theory of stupidity, which I won't get into today. But there are certain things like Bonhoeffer's theory of stupidity, Jeffrey Pornell's Iron Law of Bureaucracy, and when you take the Buckminster Fuller's concept on replacing systems rather than trying to fight them from the inside, when you accept some of these things, Stafford Beer, the purpose of the system is what it does, these great thinkers, everything gets simpler in your life. So next week I'm going to probably do a show on like 20 kind of one-liners or 10 kind of one-liners from great thinkers like the ones that I just mentioned. Anyway, with that in mind, let's go ahead and do something totally different. Solar with propane generator backup from Sean Mills.
Hey guys, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and I've got an expert panel question today. Is there an option for solar plus propane power backup? Background. A couple years ago, Generac was advertising a battery bank plus propane generator backup. I cannot find this system available on the market currently. I agree with Jack that two is one and three is for me. So my three are a grid, battery, and generator. So grid, one, battery, two, generator, three. I have both space and good southern sun exposure. I'm looking for a solid 12 kW capacity. What are your thoughts on achieving this rainbow unicorn? Is there a good prepackaged system on the market, or would I be better going with another route? So there's a couple ways to answer this. One of the things that was funny is that when I was reading this is you said your three are grid, battery, and generator, and then you talk about southern sun exposure, which would indicate a appetite for solar. So that would be four maybe. But in any case, let me answer the question that you asked. It's very easy to buy an off-the-shelf inverter that has a input for the grid, an input for battery, an input for a generator, and an AC output. Now, 12 kW is a pretty big number, and if we're talking about the output. And so this is another thing that people need to really understand when they want to take control of their power usage and they want to take the control away from that plant that's miles and miles away and all of the distribution and transmission lines in between the plant and themselves. They need to understand that there's different numbers. So when you say 12 kW, that could mean that I need to have a peak output of 12,000 watts. That could mean that I want to store 12,000 watt hours in the batteries. It could mean that I want enough solar to generate 12,000 watt hours in a day, or it could mean that I want 12,000 watts nameplate of solar panels, right? So there's a lot of different directions to go there. But it's easy to get a device that mounts on your wall. It goes in between your main panel and a sub panel. And this is a key fact here, that you have to have the inverter feeding specific loads in a sub panel, not feeding the main panel, right? Because your power grid input is going to come from the main panel. And then the way this works is, in addition to having all those functionalities I just mentioned, it is also an automatic transfer switch. So once you get this system installed, you can connect your batteries, whether that's 12,000 watt hours of batteries or 30,000 watt hours of batteries like I have at my house. And then you can program the system to say, hey, when my batteries get to 50%, I want you to charge them back up. Or in your case, you might say, I want my battery to always be at 100%. So never use battery power. Just charge my batteries up to 100 when I first plug them in and keep them at 100. Allow the grid to just pass through to my sub panel. I'm going to hook up my generator, and I'm also going to program my inverter to automatically turn my propane generator on. It's very, very easy to program automatic generator starts with these inverters if it's a propane, because a propane does not require you to manage the choke to start the generator. If you have a gas generator with one of these and you want to use the automatic generator start function, you have to have one that's got an electronically controlled choke. And those are out there. They're on the market. I think most inverter generators have that inherently, but your big portable gas generators, you know, like your Predators and Westinghouse and stuff like that, a lot of those do not have that. And it's harder, not impossible, but harder for those to work with an automatic generator start, just because if it's cold, you're going to want to choke that engine in order to get it started. So just something to think about. But you did say you wanted propane. And so, yeah, you can absolutely, you could get a much smaller propane whole house generator than what the sales guy is trying to tell you you need. You know, you could get something like 5,000 or 7,000 watts and pair that with an inverter, with a small battery bank, and with a grid input. And then now you've got the inverter on the wall. It's already got charge controllers, you know, installed. And at a later date, you could expand and add solar. This is actually what I have referred to in the past as a grid interactive system. And what you're describing is exactly what I tell people to do. Get the inverter, get a small battery bank to start with, have a generator, and have the ability to hook the generator to the inverter. Now what happens if your power goes out, all your critical loads, which are in a critical load subpanel, they don't turn off. They just switch over to battery power in the event that the grid goes down. And then you can charge those batteries back up with the generator. And then once, again, once it's in place, it's very easy to expand battery capacity or add solar after the fact. So that's your answer. I hope that helps you out, Jeff. You guys keep getting those questions into me, and I'll keep getting them answered.
And that incredibly detailed, accurate response is exactly why we have Sean Mills, a professional engineer specializing in solar, on our expert council instead of just having me answer that question, because I would have said, yes, of course you can. Just go get the stuff you need and do it. Don't ask me exactly what it is, because I don't have a system set up like that. But Sean has set up, you know, hundreds if not thousands of systems in his career, so he's seen just about every way that it can be done. Thank you to Sean and to all the folks that have served and to continue to serve in the expert council, including those who have served in the past and they did their thing for a year or two or three and they went out to do other things. I appreciate everybody that's ever been part of it. Next up, let's talk about picking a truck, and specifically in this case between three particular trucks and wanting a diesel. And I'm going to let Eric Hammond talk about this. I'm going to come back and reinforce a little bit about what he had to say about diesels. And I love diesels, but they're not for everything.
Greetings, Eric Hammond here, back with another expert council segment from Chris in Minnesota, who says, I'm looking for a new used truck. I'm torn between a Toyota Tundra, a Ford F-150, or Ram 1500. What are the known pros and cons of each? Seems like the Ram 1500 gives a lot of truck for the price tag. I want a V8, possibly a 3-liter eco-diesel Dodge, not a turbo V6 or 5.4. I want a higher trim level package, and I want to know more, and I'm really interested in the EcoDiesel that Dodge offers. This is going to sound like a segment of me bashing diesels, and I don't mean to do that. I have two diesel trucks. I got a diesel tractor. I love the diesel platform. I would never own a newer diesel, and I don't think that most people should outside of the medium and heavy-duty truck. So a light-duty truck down, economically, I don't think it's viable. If you put a pen to the paper and figure out the cost of this, it's never going to come out. There's always a higher initial cost of buying the diesel engine versus the gas engine. There's a higher operating cost associated with it, so we have to put diesel exhaust fluid in it. We have a higher fuel price at the pump. And then there's higher maintenance costs associated with it. So we're always changing out fuel filters. They generally hold more oil, bigger oil filters, and you know, there's some filters on the exhaust to catch the soot called diesel particulate filters. Those are not made for the life of the vehicle. They have a limited lifespan, and they are a consumable item. So those come with a significant cost. You're never going to come out ahead. There's a much higher breakdown potential on these new diesels. So I'd mentioned diesel exhaust fluid. So there are sensors that measure the quality of the fluid and the quantity of the fluid. If those get out of skew, it will shut you down. There's exhaust sensors all over this thing. There's usually at least four temperature sensors, plus some sensors called NOx sensors to measure the amount of pollutants that are coming out of the exhaust. If any of those fail, it will shut you down. And then lastly, you said, hey, this is Chris in Minnesota. I would never own a diesel in Minnesota. The fuel would be a potential problem itself. They were always bad about gelling diesel fuel in the wintertime, but now that we have biodiesel mixed with our fuels, it is significantly higher. And there are stations that say they have pure diesel, but a lot of times they do splash these tanks down. I have changed more filters than I care to admit that have been gelled up. It almost looks like Vaseline across the surface of the filter. It's nasty. Don't own a diesel in Minnesota. It costs too much. You're just asking for trouble. Moving on from my soapbox on diesels, you said you didn't want a turbo V6. I'm going to say that's nothing to be scared of. There are a lot of potentials to a turbo V6. And you'd mentioned you wanted a Ford or a Toyota. If you look at the Toyota Tundra for 2024, they don't even make a V8. It's only a turbo V6. Ford's had turbo V6s for years. Your fuel mileage is going to be better, and you're going to get the power that you want when you want it. So you're going to think that sounds weird because everybody complains about fuel mileage in these things. Think about this. So Ford has a 3.5 liter V6 that's turbocharged. It gets the fuel mileage of a 3.5 liter. When you put a turbo on that engine and you're forcing air into that engine, if you can double atmospheric pressure, you can effectively double the displacement of that engine. So at around 15 pounds of boost, forcing air into that engine, this 3.5 liter has become a 7 liter engine. So it has the power of a 7 liter, but it also has the fuel mileage of a 7 liter. So the people that drive these things, they love the feel of that power, and they're always in it all the time. So if you want to get the fuel mileage out of it, you got to be easy on the throttle and then use it when you need the power. But we've been putting turbos on stuff for a long time, so this is nothing to be scared of. I would not worry about that at all. When you're trying to pick between whether you want a Toyota or a Ford or a Ram, any of them are going to have lemons associated with it. So you see people, you mentioned people were complaining that Dodge has transmission issues. That's something people have been saying forever. The people that say this stuff, they're the complainers, and you only hear the complainers. I'm sure there are tons of people out there that have plenty of good vehicles and they're not saying anything about it. It's going to come down to what works best for you and the what you think the best trim level is, since you wanted a higher trim. I think that Fords have a great interior trim package. I think that Dodge is probably a close second. And then I don't really like the interiors on some of the imports like Toyota. But as far as trucks, man, Toyota makes a great truck. So I would not neglect to look at them. I think if I was going to pick between the three, I'd probably pick a Toyota first, a Ford second, and then with the Dodge. But I've had a lot of Fords and a lot of Dodges, and I like them both. You're not going to go wrong with any of them, but I hope that that helps you kind of narrow it down a little bit. Steer clear of a diesel. I'm sorry to break you on that, but I just have to get that off my chest. If anybody has any questions mechanically related that you want to ask, it could be gas, diesel, electric, two-stroke, four-stroke, storing fuel, whatever, I'd love to get it answered, so send it in, and we will take a crack at it. If you want to keep up with me, it's just Eric Hammond, The Joy of Homesteading on YouTube, and I just try and help you paint a better picture of what an abundant homestead can look like. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm going to start with what he had at toward the end about, you know, Dodge has transmission, blah, blah, blah. Every brand has a group of haters that have locked onto something and decided that's the case. It's absolute nonsense. Every vehicle will have some transmission problems. Every vehicle will have, you know, some motor problems. Out of, you know, they'll build 60,000 or 100,000 or 200,000, or in the case of some of these, like the F-150, you know, literally millions of these things that when you go year to year to year are mostly identical and change every 5 or 6 years in any significant way. And, yeah, you just hear the people that have the problem, and then they make, like, the 0.25% of these vehicles is the majority of these vehicles, and they should be ignored. Now, I do want to say something else about kind of, like, the light-duty trucks with diesel, and I would even say even a lot of the medium-duty stuff. If you're not looking at, like, at least an F-250 or equivalent, I wouldn't even look at a diesel, and I honestly think you're kind of looking at like your 30, you know, your 350 series in the equivalent, like, you know, a 3500 from Chevy or something like that. Like, that's where you should be looking when you start making that upgrade, where the power trade-offs are worth it for those larger vehicles with towing capacity and things like that. I agree with Eric. I don't think that the money will ever pencil out on the premium that you'll pay on a diesel for, you know, an F-150 series or equivalent to it. I think gas motors, we're really good at building them. We've been building them for over 100 years. Like you said, we've been putting turbos on them for more than half a century. We know how to do this. And so I wouldn't shy away from either of those either. And I'm also of the opinion that if you want a used diesel, you want a, you know, like 2005 back. You want to go prior to the DEF age. I would rather own a good, like, if I want a daily driver that's going to be nice and comfortable, and I also kind of want, like, a, you know, a mid-sized diesel truck, I'd rather have, like, a 1980s Cugvee out of military surplus as my beater truck with that diesel in it and a really decent modern, you know, gas vehicle if I want a decent modern vehicle. That's just my opinion there. And what some of those can be had for, and, you know, we did shows on these in the past with, like, Tim Glantz when he was still around here. You know, you can put, like, the 10 most common parts that break in a toolbox in the back of one of the Cut Vs or one of the Blazer-style ones and in a toolbox and a technical manual and basic mechanics equipment, and you can fix that damn thing for 90% of what would ever go wrong with it anywhere on the planet that you broke down. And so there is some utility to those older vehicles, but modern diesels, unless you're putting some serious heft behind what you're doing, I just don't think you'll ever get your value out of it. And, you know, it will just cost more for everything that you ever have done mechanically on it if you're not going to do your own work. And it's both because there is a premium to some of it, and it's also because there's a premium with having diesel certification for a technician. So a lot of shops, they'll have a diesel master tech or something like that. And let's say you bring your vehicle in to have some shit done on it that has nothing to do with the fact that it's a diesel. But it's enough of a job to pay well to the mechanic who does the work. Let's say you need a new starter motor. A lot of times, I'm not saying all shops, but a lot of shops will say, well, our master diesel tech's not in until Wednesday. And not only will you pay more for his hours, you will wait longer to get your repair done. when any tech could replace a starter motor, it doesn't really matter. Again, I'm not saying all shops do this. I'm saying some do. I've seen it happen. I find it to be despicable, but I know why they're doing it. Diesel techs tend to earn a better wage, and a lot of shops will have a diesel tech in the shop 2 or 3 days a week. And he'll work 2 or 3 shops, and he'll move around, and they need enough work to keep him interested in coming back. So they will put aside work like that for him, especially when the customer's dumb enough to not know that they don't need a master diesel tech because their truck says diesel on the frickin' tailgate. And a lot of them don't. Anyway, moving on, let's talk about mold and health risks for handymans, contractors, etc.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Today's question for the expert council concerns mold. Roman asks, how dangerous is mold, and what are first symptoms of inhaled mold causing health issues? Expanded question. I do a bit of restoration and renovation work on the side, and sometimes come across mold damage, old building dried mold, and all sorts of other fungi. It's my understanding that mold can be quite harmful if inhaled. Would a standard respirator air filter that painters use suffice when dealing with mold? What health damage could mold cause, and most importantly, what would be my first symptoms to notice to seek medical attention? Thank you, and hope to hear from you soon. Thanks. Roman, mold is a fungal growth produced especially on damp surfaces, decaying organic matter, and even on living organisms. Mold, well, that's part of a natural, normal ecosystem outdoors, and indeed molds play a part in breaking down dead organic matter such as fallen leaves and dead trees. It's indoor mold that's problematic and should be avoided due to possible risks to your health. Mold may begin growing indoors when spores land on surfaces that are wet, like kitchen counters, bathroom fixtures, storage areas, and basements. There are many types, all of which require moisture to grow. Mold is particularly an issue after flooding events. When mold spores drop on places where there's excessive moisture, such as where leakage may have occurred in roofs, pipes, walls, plant pots, or where there has been flooding, they will grow. Many building materials provide suitable nutrients that encourage mold to grow, as a matter of fact. Wet cellulose material, including paper and paper products, cardboard, ceiling tiles, wood and wood products, these are particularly conducive for the growth of some molds. Other materials such as dust, paints, wallpaper, insulation materials, drywall, carpet, fabric, and upholstery commonly support mold growth. That's a lot. I was surprised to find that the CDC seems to believe that most molds aren't a real threat to otherwise healthy people, but some molds do produce mycotoxins that can pose serious health risks to humans and animals, especially if ingested. Prolonged exposure in the home may be particularly harmful. Now, for some people, mold can cause a stuffy nose, sore throat, coughing, sneezing, or wheezing, itchy burning eyes, or a skin rash. Any of these symptoms experienced while working around mold might merit a visit to an allergist or other health professional. Unfortunately, there aren't really any lab tests that pinpoint when or where a particular mold exposure took place. People who are asthmatic or who are allergic to mold may have severe reactions. Immune-compromised people and people with chronic lung disease may also get infections in their lungs from mold. These people should see a lung specialist known as a pulmonologist. Having said all that, some people seem to suffer little effect when they're exposed. It should be noted that mycotoxins in mold have also been used to benefit humans when the toxicity is directed against other organisms. For example, penicillin mold is famously known to adversely affect the growth of certain microbes. Roman, as you do restoration and renovation work, you probably encounter mold every so often. You would be best served by having some good masks on hand. If worn properly, P95 or 100s would be useful, and even N95 or N100s would give you some protection. The magazine Environmental Design and Construction gives suggestions, including the Breath Buddy respirator, which comes with goggles as well, and a number of 3M products, including the 3M Mold Removal Respirator, the 3M Full Face Piece Respirator 6800, and others. Now, here are guidelines for the amount of protection you'll need. Minimum masks are suitable for minor mold remediation tasks in contaminated areas that are 10 feet or smaller in size. Limited respirators are either half or full face masks with air purifying properties. Their P100 filter makes them ideal for spaces between 10 and 100 feet in area. Full-face respirators are for extreme mold protection in spaces 100 feet or larger. They help purify the air you breathe while protecting you from spores. Now, if you found mold, eliminating the moisture source is the first step at fungal remediation. Removal of all affected materials may be necessary if materials are easily replaceable and not part of the load-bearing structure. Professional drying of concealed walled cavities and enclosed spaces such as cabinet spaces may be required. Post-remediation verification is important, and many contractors do this themselves, but property owners may better benefit from independent sources. Let's talk about prevention. Inside your home, you can control mold growth by controlling humidity levels. 30 to 50% is ideal. Get a dehumidifier if necessary, and don't skimp on the air conditioning in humid months. Promptly fix leaky roofs, windows, and pipes. Thoroughly clean and dry immediately after a flooding event. A wet vac is a good investment. Avoid placing carpet anywhere that can get wet. Remove and replace as needed. And ventilating shower, laundry, and cooking areas with exhaust fans, that's also important. Mold growth can be removed from hard surfaces with commercial products, soap and water, or a bleach solution of no more than 1 cup, that's 8 ounces of bleach, in 1 gallon of water to kill mold on surfaces. Never mix bleach with ammonia or other household cleaners. Wear gloves and other personal protection. I should mention that basic N95 respirator masks do not protect against gases and chemicals. If you're working on a construction project or in an area with severe mold growth, you should also wear disposable gloves and protective goggles for further protection. Never tackle a mold project unprotected. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
Great stuff as always from Doc Bones. Let's move on, and now we're going to hear about shrooms. Not those kind of shrooms. Not the purple ones you get from underneath the cow patties. Please, please don't go pick purple mushrooms out from under cow patties. I don't know enough to advise on anything other than about 5 species of mushrooms. But one thing I do know about is morels, and they are delicious. And I'll tell you my little way I like to have them after you hear from Nicole on her favorite recipe for these, kind of the king of spring shrooms, I think. I can't think of anything I'd rather eat that you can find in the spring than these guys. Let's go ahead and hear from Nicole.
Howdy, TSP. Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Hollow Roast Coffee with a question in from the Telegram group about morel mushrooms. That's right. It is morel season. And I don't know about you, but I am jealously watching, enviously watching a bunch of people post pictures of their morels that they are finding on mushroom walks. And alas, though I have walked, I have not found yet. Even all of my favorite spots have not broken yet this year. So here's hoping that happens, though. But the question is this. It's, what are your favorite recipes to use morel mushrooms? Because it is mushroom season right now. Well, here's the deal, guys. I like to keep it simple with morels. If you want to taste the flavor of this mushroom, the deal is don't hide them in stuff. And so what I like to do is dice them up, saute some onions and garlic in butter, and then toss the morels in that and just eat that straight up as a side dish. You can also pair it with some spinach, which is a nice light flavor to go with the morel mushrooms. But that's 100% my favorite way to eat morels. I would like to say, before moving on to the next part of this thought, don't eat them raw. You want to cook the morel mushrooms. If you eat them raw, it can cause some issues. So they are safe to eat, but after cooked. And the other thing is that there are morels and there are fake morels. And the way you know that it's a real morel is if you cut it in half and it's hollow up in that little wizard's hat, then you know that that's a real morel. And if it's solid, do not eat that. Just, you know, whenever you're going to source wild edible plants, it's a good idea to know what the wild edible is, especially on something that can make you have gastrointestinal distress. So from here, I thought we should crowdsource this. So I know a lot of you listening to Jack love morels, you love mushroom hunting, and you have your favorite recipes for morel mushrooms. let me know what they are. And maybe we can like toss this back and forth. I think that'd be really fun. You can either do it by hitting me up in email, Nicole@livingfreeintennessee.com, or go to the comments of this Expert Council show and just put your stuff in the comments. And when I see it, I'll hop in and give opinions back and forth. Now, from here, the final thought I have is there are other ways that I have used Morels, because last year I ended up, I think, with about 100 pounds of Morels. Maybe not that many. Maybe it was more like 25 pounds. But somebody else found them. They dehydrated them. I bought them from them because I had not found any Morels last year. And that's been my primary mushroom source for the year. So whenever I'm making a super stew that I want mushrooms in, I soak those in a little bit of water, dice them up, and then throw them in the stew. I know it's a terrible waste of Morels, but it's also delicious. Putting them in with a stroganoff also works really, really well. And then anytime I'm doing any kind of vegetable saute where I think this could use a little something, something, Morels. That's what's been happening here. But if you ask me what my favorite way is, onions, garlic, fresh Morels, salt and pepper to taste, in butter, and if you're feeling jiggy, add some spinach. So let me know, how do you like your Morels? Man, I was going to close right there, and then I realized, you know, I would be lax if I did not let you know that if you're really into wild edible plants and learning about them, that our buddy Carrie from Strong Roots Resources is going to be at the Self-Reliance Festival in Camden, Tennessee, April 6th and 7th, doing wild edible walks, and he has a workshop the Monday afterwards that's a longer, more detailed look at wild edibles, how to use them, how to identify them, that sort of thing, with tangible examples that we can find on the compound there. Find out more about that at selfreliancefestival.com. Make it a great week.
So I'll start. I'm all big on cooking them by themselves and just eating them. My big difference is I'm more of salt, pepper, butter, garlic to cook them with. And then this is my favorite thing, is to cook them, but then serve them in a sauce. And the sauce that's the boss here is if you do something like a slow-cooked short rib in a red wine reduction. I don't want to just throw them in there, though. What I want to do with them is have them already cooked and just, when you serve them, put that red wine reduction that comes out with your short ribs. You can do this with things other than short ribs. Any slow-cooked beef, like Osso Buco, works really good for this. But the other thing that works really good is to find yourself a trimmed brisket on sale and cut that into chunks that are kind of similar to short ribs, and you get a lot more bang for your buck that way because it's not half-bone. And do that just like you would do a red wine braised short rib. And that on Morels is incredible. By the way, if you heard me a little indecisive at the end there, like, is there anything better? What actually came in my mind is maitakes, also known as hen of the woods, but they're a fall mushroom. So that's why I was kind of stammering a little bit there at the end. I was trying to think, is there a mushroom that I like better than Morels? And it would either be, yeah, that, and maybe chanterelles. But I don't know, man. They're hard to beat. Let's hear now from, we're going to hear from Nick Ferguson on patented and trademarked plants when it comes to propagation and resale.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com here with an expert counsel answer for David on patented and trademarked plants. Is Nick Ferguson still a council member? If not, ignore this. If so, I'd love to hear his answer. Of course I am. I'm on like twice a month, dude. So let me get to the question. When propagating plants with the goal of starting a backyard nursery, how do you know you are not using patented or trademarked plants? I'd like to start a backyard nursery, and I'm looking to see what are some good plants to start that I could propagate and sell, but I keep running across information saying to be careful to not use patented and trademarked plants, as it's illegal to propagate and sell those. How do you know if the plants you want to grow are patented or not? Also, are you still working on a propagation course, and if so, when will it be available? Thanks, David. Okay, so let's first get a handle on what those two terms mean. Patented means the plant's genome is owned by someone. It's likely a hybrid. or a sport or a mutation that is propagated clonally with tissue culture, most likely, or cuttings of some kind. Those plant patents last 20 years. You can look them up and see when the patent expires and ready your nursery to take advantage of a soon expiring patent since they cannot be renewed. Trademarked means the name and branding are owned by someone and you can't use that trademarked name and or branding. Pink Lady apples, for instance, are patented under the name Cripps Pink, but they're trademarked under the name Pink Lady. That patent expired in 2010, so you're free to propagate and sell those Pink Lady or Cripps Pink apple trees all you want, but only if you sell them as Cripps Pink or some other name. The trademark is still restricted, and you can, and that trademark can be extended indefinitely, just like the brand name Coke. But you can still propagate that tree, you just can't sell it under that trademark name, just like you couldn't sell, you know, a carbonated beverage called Coke. So how can you know if a plant is patented? Well, if you know for sure that it's patented, you know. If you purchased it and it has a plant patent number on the tag, then you know. If it's trademarked, it will likewise have a tag with an R or a TM after the name, like Knockout Roses, for instance. Most likely, you're going to see an R, which means it's a registered trademark. TM actually doesn't mean that you own it, per se. It just means that you are saying that you own it. Officially, it's unlawful to knowingly propagate patented plants without first obtaining permission and likely paying royalties to the patent owner. You aren't even allowed to let it root by layering without violating the laws on plant patents. I personally think that's absurd, but such is life. Legally speaking, you can be sued and held liable for violating any of those laws, so it's very unadvisable to knowingly propagate patented plants, and especially stupid to sell them under their registered and trademark names. So, if you're looking for good nursery plants, there are a ton of good ornamentals that you should look into, and edibles. Just browse newly expired patents, or patents that will be expiring in a few years. Buy some of those plants, start growing them, so that when it's viable to propagate them, you're ready to go. I bet you could even ask ChatGPT or some other AI to be a plant patent expert and teach you what top fill-in-the-blank plants have patents that have expired in the past decade or are about to expire in the next 5 years. From a more agorist approach to the issue, you could certainly ask the following question: who is going around to backyard nurseries and doing genome testing on all their bushes? Then you could make a determination as to whether the risk of legal action is worth it for you, or if you have moral qualms about the alleged violation of a plant patent. As for the propagation course, working on it currently, I'd like to get it finished before releasing. I've played around with the idea of doing a subscription and releasing it piecemeal, but I really want to get it complete, or at least the first segment, done before releasing. My old course is going through an edit and re-release and might be available soon if all of my juggling of life and consulting settles down just a smidge. I'm just super busy. I've been swamped with consulting requests and life in general. So, on that note, if you've emailed me and somehow I dropped the ball and didn't get back to you, please let me know. I'm sure I've forgotten a couple people. I've hired an assistant to help with scheduling and general organization. So if you want to get on the consulting tours for this year, please let me know with an email to N-I-C-K, that's Nick, at homegrownliberty.com. Hope to see a boatload of people at the upcoming Self-Reliance Festival in Camden the weekend of the 6th and 7th, where I'll be speaking on fodder trees and feed store independence. I'll have a few handfuls of tree bundles available at a discount if you're attending, so get there Saturday morning for first chance at those bundles. You can sign up at selfreliancefestival.com. I hope to see you there. Keep those great questions coming. I'm Nick Ferguson from rareplantstore.com and homegrownliberty.com. Do good things.
So there is something there that Nick sort of alluded to but really didn't go into. He said you can look up the patent number to see when the patent was filed and therefore when the patent expires. So I want to make you aware of something that certain plant breeders and catalogs do. So usually when it's a catalog company, they're just receiving the description and information from the supplier, and if it's a patented variety and they list in there the patent and the number, then they include that in their catalog. And if you go to certain suppliers, they may also be the patent holder. So like the biggest offender of this, and this is why I'm calling them out, is Ison's Nursery and Vineyards, who is really well known in the world of muscadines. And they sell a ton of different muscadines, including many that they held the patent on. Notice the tense of the verb I use there. Held. Not hold. Held. As in no longer. And why? Well, some of the patents that Ison's has now on some of their muscadines is 25, 30, 35 years old or even older. Well, as Nick told you, 20 years and you're done. And you can't, you cannot re-patent a plant. Basically, what the government has determined is that if you create a new plant variety, that 20 years, two decades of being protected, of being the only one that can sell it without license, is enough. And you need to go do something else to provide value, or you don't get that protection anymore. You make a new plant variety that's unique and improve it, and you can patent that for 20 years. So what do these companies do? They will put protected under patent number, blah, 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 blah on it. And most people will look at that and say, oh, I can't propagate that and sell it under that name of the patented variety. However, if you actually look up the patent, you'll see that it's no longer in force. And again, Ison's is the worst about this, but that's, you know, not meaning that they're the only ones that do this. Just gonna say it. And then if you're in a backyard nursery, Nick kind of alluded to this, what are the odds somebody's going to do metagenomic testing of your plant variety that you're propagating? And the idea that you're not even supposed to let layering happen or whatever, what about a patented blackberry? Those things propagate themselves. So there's a limit into what they can actually do. Never assign them more power than they actually have. But one thing I would say that he's dead on about, I would not reproduce patented varieties and sell them. It's not worth it. There's too many other options. Trademark varieties, he covered that really well, but I will also say this. There are loopholes in everything, so commonly sold under the name of in a description is not a violation of a trademark as long as you include the TM in that. What you market it as, like your top-line marketing variety, that needs to be some unique name of your own, or in some cases, you might have a patented variety that has expired, and you could, again, like Nick said, use the name of the patented variety rather than the trademark, because anybody can trademark anything. That's something most people don't realize. You can come up with anything that you say makes your particular version of it unique, and then put a trademark name on it, and you market the name, and you're protecting the name. Just some thoughts. But it doesn't mean anything. Trademark means jack shit about propagation, only the name under which it is sold or marketed. With that, let's go ahead and get into my topic today, which is going to be on the concept of, if something's working, do you need to change it? The question today comes from Marcus. He says, is grass-fed cattle dung better than compost for growing all plants? That's the first question. But here's the real question. I live in southeast Texas, 12.9 acres. I have 5 to 8 head of cattle at any given time. My wife collects the dried cattle dung and top dresses all the plants she's interested in growing on our property. It all seems to be growing great, and she gets pretty decent harvest. Should we bother with different methods of composting? Okay, so the way I'm taking this is I have something that works. I've heard about another thing that also is said to work and maybe be better. Do I need to be doing this? And the answer, like the short version of this for Marcus, is you don't have to do shit you don't want to do. And if you're happy with your results, there's no need for you, need being the opportune word there, to even consider changing what you're doing. I will say that the longer cattle manure rots, the more useful it becomes. And there's another name for rotting an organic substance, and that would be composting. So some of this is already going on. So it sounds like she's picking up dry pies and maybe crumbling them around her vegetables and what have you, and it's all working great. If you're happy with the way things are doing that and you have that resource at your disposal and it's always going to be there, then you don't need to do anything else. Why might you want to? Well, you're using a single source amendment, and that single source amendment is primarily a nitrogen amendment. If we were making compost, we would consider pure manure, even though there is some carbon in it, because that's how cow patties work. We would consider that to be nitrogen. So if we wanted to do about a 20% nitrogen to 80% carbon compost, we would need, you know, for every 200 pounds of the dry manure, we would need about 800 pounds of a carbon like straw or wood chips, right? So it's all already at that point different. With compost, and this is something I tried to make very clear in my composting course, we're not so much worried about NPK. We're worried about biology and increasing biology. And by increasing soil biology, we increase soil structure and tilth. We have a dramatic impact on what are called the five spheres of the soil, like the aggratosphere and the drillosphere and stuff like that. That will all be in my cover crop course that's coming up. And so if we want to increase microbiological activity in soil, the manure helps, but a good quality long-duration compost will help more. So if you are getting good yields and you're happy and, you know, you're doing almost no or minimal irrigation and you're not looking to reduce irrigation or whatever, then maybe you'll be fine forever. And maybe you won't. I don't know. I don't know. How long have you been gardening on this property? What was it treated like before you got there? And what is the longevity of your current method? So by going to maybe doing a single pile of compost a year and then using the compost very just small amounts of it in additional soil amendment, but also making things like extracts and or teas and applying that as a foliar spread or making a slurry and applying it to seed for any crops you're direct seeding, you may dramatically increase your yields or you may not. It depends on how good your yields already are. It depends on a variety of things. How old is that manure when it's being applied? Is it just like it dried out, but it's from like last month, or has it been laying around for months and begin to break down more? And what I'll tell you is, because you're talking about grass-fed cattle here, with some mind, you know, some mind to you need to not over-fertilize anything. You use as much as you want. When people are getting cattle manure from feedlots and stuff like that, or dairy manure, that stuff by dry weight is 5% salt because of the diet those animals are fed in those conditions. When you're looking at animals that are free range or paddock shift grazing, you're very low sodium. And so one of the things when you are getting, well, what is your source of manure? And when we go to a composting method that the biological activity locks a lot of the salts up is one component to it. But the other component is we're not using large amounts of it anymore. Now we're using, you know, a dusting as a top dressing to a garden versus, you know, laying down 4 or 5, 6 inches of it. Because, again, we're not so concerned about direct fertility. We are more concerned about the biological activity that is applying. So my other thing would be that with that many cattle, it's way more manure than you need that you can collect. And so what you may simply want to do is, if you have a good source of carbon, is a slow static pile compost over time, where we build us a cage with maybe some air ventilation like we do with a bioreactor, and we just keep adding to that until it's full. And for every, you know, couple shovelfuls of cow manure that go in there, a few shovelfuls of a carbon, or, you know, 10 shovelfuls of carbon to 2 shovelfuls of broken down manure, and just build that up and let it age. And that approach alone will bring more biodiversity into what you're doing. And you'll probably notice when you do break it down, you know, a year and a half after you've filled it up, that it will probably be just completely swarming with earthworms. And that alone will tell you a lot about the biological activity there. But let's take it a little bit to a higher level here. With this decision applying to just about anything, whether it's an agricultural thing like do I or do I not need to add biochar to what I'm doing? You know, in that situation, are you irrigating? Yeah, then you'll probably benefit from biochar from that alone because of the additional water holding capacity. But it doesn't mean that you need to do it. And there's so many things in our lives like this. This new product, do I need this product? This new system, should I integrate, you know, some form of additional self-defense into my martial arts routine? Do I add an exercise to my weight training? Do I, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, do I hire a new person into my business? Am I ready to expand? What we always have to do when we're making that decision is we need to put ourselves in the right frame of mind. Yesterday, when I had this amazing interview, it was just one of the best interviews I've had, certainly of the year, if not in the last 5 years, with Zach Weiss. At some point in that interview, he said something, and I don't even think I said it. I think I just dropped it into the live chat. And it's that we need to get people thinking in seven generations, but our first challenge is to get them even to think as far out as 7 years. And that really is a profound thought. And without what Zach was saying at the time, I probably would have never thought of it that way. But this is something that we need to put into our decision-making about things like this. In Marcus's concept, you know, he's probably doing tomatoes and peppers and the typical things every gardener does, maybe some beans and whatever. If they were to start making compost on the initial application, they may not notice that big of a gain. So even if they had made the compost 6 months ago with a standard high-turn compost and giving it aging time, the day that they throw that on there, they may not see that much. And even that first season, if they already have really good results, whatever that means, because that's a subjective concept, they might not notice that much. But what is the impact across developing that microbiology across 7 years? And what happens, you know, and where he's at is a fairly dry climate, very hot climate in summer anyway. But when we have a standout summer that's unusually hot and unusually dry even for the area, how much more resilient does it become after a season or two or three? If I hire somebody into my business and it begins to grow an entire new revenue unit in the business and allows me to expand into another niche or sub-niche, then it may not do much for me the first 90 days that guy works there, and at the end of the first year, I may have just basically brought in enough new revenue to pay for him. But if it's a growth sector that it's allowing me to go at, and there's a lot of other things that could be going on with growing a business with employee headcount, I need to be thinking about, what does this do for me, my business 5, 7, 8, 9, 10 years down the road? And that's how we need to start thinking more and more and more, coming back to where this started at with agriculture, right? Agriculture, permaculture, regenerative agriculture, etc. We have to get out of the short-term thinking. So, like, one of the people I really love in that space, Steven Reisner, and I do, I mean, the guy is a genius, a literal genius. You know, his opinion of biochar is, don't bother if you have good results because it won't matter, because we did one planting in Colorado where we used 10% biochar, and I still don't know what that means, by the way, Steven. Like, 10% of the compost that you put down, and how much, like, how much? I don't know, right? Like, but they're basically two fields, and the one with biochar, and they added fertilizer, so it wasn't a rigged study where they made it look bad on purpose. Basically, the yields were pretty much the same. Well, you know, I look at studies done with biochar where they don't do anything special. They're just simply cleaning up drop limbs and stuff like that in forests as part of forest management, and then scatter the biochar. And they did this very detailed experiment, the one I'm talking about, where so they burned up all of the undergrowth so that it wasn't a fire hazard. This was done in Oregon, who's much better at managing their forests than, let's say, California, by the way. And they took all the biochar into one plot that was like a test plot, and they just threw the biochar on the ground and did absolutely nothing else. They took another plot where they put down, you know, wood chips. They took another plot where they put down fertilizer. They took another plot where they put down compost. There's like five different scenarios that they created. And in the first season, the place that they just threw the biochar, when they measured the biomass growth in that plot, and this is just native forest, it was actually slightly less than all the others. By 2 to 3 years into it, it was, you know, like the number two, number three, depending on how you compared it, in biomass growth. But at 5 years and on, it blew all the others away. In fact, there was one that was biochar and fertilizer, and one that was straight biochar. And the one that had the biochar and fertilizer did better early on, but long term, the one that never had any chemical fertilizer applied to it, no synthetic fertilizers, it did the best out of all of them. But you had to look 5 to 7 years out to see the result. And so my advice when making any decision that is, things are already good, I don't know that they need to be better, to be thinking more about the next half decade than the next 4 or 5 months in that decision. Then there's another thing I want to say about that. Anything you do differently could change your results to the negative. Because you did it wrong, because it wasn't what you thought it was, because you got bad advice, right? Now, I think making compost is not bad advice, but you can make bad compost if you don't do it right. You also, when you're talking about dynamic systems, like a business, even though it's not really a living organism, it kind of acts like one. It has all these moving parts. Or when you look at agriculture, permaculture, horticulture, it's definitely a living system with lots of moving living parts in it. Something you do could have a negative consequence, even if it doesn't seem like it could. So I would tell anybody that you, when you try something new for the first time, you may want to isolate it to a given area. That way, not only do you know that if it goes wrong, you have a backup, but if is it better? Is it better? Like, there's a lot of things I do wholesale now everywhere. But when I first started doing fungal inoculation, I inoculated these things, and I didn't inoculate those things. That way I could look side by side in my backyard, not in a magazine, which one worked better. And I also can then over time say, look at how, even though I started doing inoculation everywhere, the places I did it first, they're still doing better because the accumulation of biological life in the soil has gone higher over time since I started there earlier. And so I think we have to like do that again in your business, in your life, in all your decisions. We need to stop thinking about just next week, or even just next quarter, or even just next year. We have to start thinking at least in that 5 to 7 year time frame, or we'll never be the old men planting trees under whose shade we know we shall never sit, and then we will not be leaving behind a society that grows great, to kind of chop up and reassemble that old Greek proverb of a society grows great when old men plant trees under whose shade they know they shall never sit. Anyway, with that wrapped up, I want to remind you guys, if you like the show and the work that we do, you can do your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Today's item of the day is the same one as yesterday. It's the Vivor 50-pound automatic poultry feeder. Since I've installed it, my granddaughter has completely filled it up, and she's overjoyed that she's going to have basically to do her job one day a week. Though Grandma explained to her today that there will be other jobs that fill in for not doing that job anymore. But this thing is awesome. It's a really great price. It's about $50 for a 50-pound feeder. It's made out of galvanized steel, super easy to mount, super easy to take care of. And, you know, what I did with mine, I left the pans that they've been eating out of next to it until they wiped them out, and they immediately started feeding out of the new feeder. Like, they figured it out pretty quick. So, if you're worried about something like that, it's a pretty simple switchover. All I know is now my feed isn't going to get ruined in the rain, and it's not going to get wasted. And I do have one piece of advice on feed in general, in addition to these feeders, and it's any feeder. Your life will just be better, and you will have less waste if you buy pelletized versus crumbled feed. I'll leave it at that. With that, I hope you enjoyed today's show. I want to remind you also that you can become a member of the Survival Podcast Member Support Brigade if you have not done so already, and it is the number one way we pay the bills around here. You'll get a ton of discounts. It'll cover the cost of your membership probably multiple times over per year, so it doesn't actually cost anything in real dollars. If you save $150 on a $50 membership, you got paid $100 to be a member. That's the way I look at it, and I built it so that math would be easy to work out and make happen. So check it out today at thesurvivalpodcast.com/ members if you want to know more about becoming an MSB member. With that, again, thank you for tuning in today. Tomorrow we'll catch you with a Friday flashback, and next week we'll do it all over again.
Bail you out, just run you around. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.